Ladies and gentlemen, storytellers of all ages, lend your ears to co-hosts Brad and Philip as we delve into the Marketing Your Attraction podcast.
Welcome to episode 26 of the Marketing Your Attractions podcast. I'm Brad Jashinsky, and I'm here with Philip Hernandez. We're going to be diving into adding value, aka upcharges at attractions. I feel like adding value is definitely the marketer's way of saying, how do we get more money out of our guests, but doing it in a way that they feel good about giving us that money. Anyway, how are you doing this week?
Well, I'm doing fantastic. I'm excited for this episode.
Yeah. It's not fall yet, but it feels like fall. We're recording this on September 1st. I have my pumpkin candle going.
Nice.
It's a little cooler here in Southern California. I mean, it's like 82, so it's not that cool, but it's feeling a little bit more like the Halloween season every day, which is really exciting.
I'm making my plans for the Halloween season to go and making a list of who I'm going to go visit, and we're getting in a lot of haunts saying over their news releases and photos and press information. And it's just making me have a bunch of envy for the places I can't make it to. So I'm like, oh man, these all seem so cool.
I know, I'm doing the same thing. There's just never enough time to see all of them. Even in the Southern California market, there's so many great attractions to check out during the season. And hopefully we'll have a chance to highlight some of them in future episodes. But you know what? For this week, let's dive into the news. It's from Bloomberg. It's talking about how Amazon has YouTube envy. This is talking about how Amazon, which owns Twitch.tv, which is the live streaming platform that is very, very popular in the video game industry, especially in esports, how Amazon wants Twitch to eventually be a true YouTube competitor and break out of the gaming space and really be a video hub, both live streaming and also recorded videos for all sorts of subjects. So something to keep a look on, something to keep an eye on is Twitch. I think for most attractions out there, it doesn't necessarily make sense right now because it is still very gaming focused, but they have a very unique audience. It skews pretty young, which is great for a lot of seasonal attractions. They have some interesting software. And of course, because they were purchased by Amazon, you know they're going to continue to be a major player and another platform for us to keep track of, which, more competition is always good. But it is always a little frustrating in digital marketing, especially. Every single time you think you have all the platforms figured out, there's another one you have to keep an eye on. But I just wanted to mention that because I was not super aware of Twitch. I had not used it much before I joined Razer, the gaming company I work for now, and transitioned out of the attractions industry. And of course, in the gaming industry, Twitch in a lot of ways is even bigger than YouTube. So just something to keep an eye on. I also wanted to just kind of discuss some of the announcements that were made this week and last week. This is sort of theme park announcement season for a lot of the regional parks. And I think it's always beneficial to take a look at how the big players announce their giant multi-million dollar rides out there. Canada's Wonderland announced the world's tallest dive coaster. Six Flags Magic Mountain is doing an interesting partnership with the TV show and car building company West Coast Customs for a new racing launch coaster that'll be coming to their California park. Carowinds also announced the launch coaster in the Carolinas. We saw Scary Farm, my old home. They just did their announcement event the other day. And then, of course, all the other Six Flags parks announced smaller attractions, mostly just through different web video releases. But it was really interesting to see how many parks did big events to announce their new, either new seasonal attractions in the case of Scary Farm or even their big new attractions. And definitely something to keep an eye on. I think for most smaller attractions out there, doing a big live announcement event is probably cost prohibitive and doesn't necessarily make sense. I think, creating a really nice high quality video and, using that to release the news about your attraction for the season, just like many of the Six Flags parks are doing, is definitely a tactic to copy. And who knows, maybe we'll even see some smaller attractions, live stream announcement events. Philip, did you have a chance to check out any of the announcement events, any takeaways or anything?
Well, unfortunately not. I was gonna go the Knots one, but I didn't make it there in time. I had a fiasco at LAX and you know, et cetera, et cetera. It's always, and I know Brad's had firsthand experience with this. It's always impressed me that Scary Farm does the announcement event that they do, and kind of make a show out of it. Cause I think that really allows for a larger media bump around their seasonal event. It's not the same as announcing a coaster, but I like the show elements to it. And this year they did a live stream of it. I don't know if they did that last year. Brad would know, but you know, they did a live stream and people can log in and watch that. And I like that they're kind of taking control of it. You know, like we're creating an event to tell our story of how we're launching. And we're also putting out the official live feed for it and doing that. I like all of those elements, which I think just encourages the press to share it and kind of take that and send it out.
Yeah. I mean, to give a little bit of background, the announcement event was started the year before I started at Knott's Scary Farm, and my old boss, Jason Soyster, who's now up at Great America, he created it in 2013. And back then it was a smaller event, and it was much earlier in the summer. And so it took us a couple of years to kind of figure out how big an event can we make this? And I think the key was 2014 or 2015, probably 2015, when we began inviting more and more fans to really just amplify the social presence. And it just gives the event more energy. And there's really something, to your point, of controlling the delivery of your message, but also just getting all of the media outlets together to talk about the event. It's just, there's just more excitement in the air. You get longer articles, you get more videos, you get more photos of it. Something that would have been a little blurb on a website becomes all of these different assets that are being amplified throughout social media and traditional media as well. So instead of getting that one little article, you are getting the live stream, you're getting live updates during the announcement event from the media, you're getting behind the scenes interviews, Q&A interviews with the designers, photos, of course, mini videos, and it takes, Scary Farm, which usually only has, a handful of new mazes every single year, it takes their lineup and makes it feel really big and fun and fresh and new, even though their lineup may not on the surface be as new and fresh as Horror Nights, at least in terms of the number of new mazes. The announcement event always gave the Knott's team the opportunity to talk about why each maze was so special, some of the nuances of what was coming, what was being refreshed in some of the mazes, and just really got the message out there, loud and clear, instead of just having a little blurb out there or a press release. But those events are very tricky, very expensive to do, and probably don't make sense except for some of the bigger attractions. But I think Scary Farm over the years, all the team that has worked on that, came together and really figured out how to make an event that just perfectly sells that brand. And a big part of that is the media, but an even bigger part of that is the great Scary Farm monsters and the great fans that make that event happen. So I don't know how many attractions would be able to replicate that, but who knows? I think even just getting the media together and doing a behind the scenes tour of your attraction and really going in depth and showing what's new and all of the work, blood, sweat, and tears that have been put into it, it could be a really good tactic for it. And I think we covered a little bit of that in, I can't remember the episode number, but when we were talking about doing media events and press kits and, how you can try to make your, smaller attraction, smaller news still compete and feel like a bigger announcement. But yeah, in summary, definitely check out some of those different announcement strategies that, Canada's Wonderland and all the Six Flags parks and Carowinds and Scary Farm have employed this month, or I should say last month. So moving on from that news, Philip, you had a couple of interesting stories. Speaking of doing things differently, I was really impressed by these. Tell us more.
So I found a few stories a few weeks ago. One is from DigiDay, which is Skull Candy Creates Live Concert Series as part of Content Marketing Push. I absolutely love this because I think it's a great example of content marketing, and it's a great example of really creating something meaningful, which will tie to the next topic as well, but really something meaningful for your audience. So I'm going to read a blurb here from the article. Young consumers are very savvy, and they're very savvy about paid influencers. Obviously, we're a commercial entity, and of course, we want to sell headphones, but we want the music to be pure. Of course, Skull Candy can and does retarget attendees and viewers with more commercial advertisements after the fact. Skull Candy spends the majority of its marketing budget on digital ads, unlike Apple and Bose, it doesn't buy TV or print ads. So, a note from the series, but basically, Skull Candy is creating this live concert series for then videoing and sending back out for people to view after the fact, but they also have a limited number of live tickets. So it's like a way to reward customers for coming into live concerts. But it's also, as they said here, you know, it's a way, they obviously mentioned here about their retargeting. You know, we retarget attendees and viewers with more commercial advertisements after the fact. So they're tracking the viewers of this live concert. I think it's brilliant. Like you're partnering with music creators because you're paying them to do a concert, and they're not forcing them to wear Skull Candy headphones while they're performing or while they're recording, but obviously most of them do. You know, they get good placement and they get good alignment. It introduces them kind of directly to the people that are actually making the music, which is why you purchase, you know, Skull Candy headphones, is to listen to the music, and then it gives you a direct line to the people that are actually making the thing that your fan actually loves. You know, you're just like a vehicle for getting to that. I think all around it's a great campaign for this content marketing push. And I do like how they're able to kind of show some classic ROI here by doing retargeting with it. But it also points here, that I put it here at the end, about the spending the majority of its budget on digital ads. Content marketing can this type of marketing campaign, depending on the size of your company, can be a difficult push because it's kind of outside of typical marketing. And I think it definitely helps that effort that Skull Candy is a majority online marketing company, because it's a much easier, basically an easier sell to people that already do a lot of online advertising. I guess how I would have seen this pitch going is they're saying, hey, we want to make a really good video to get a lot of retargeting out of, you know, a really good lead magnet, basically. So what if we did a live concert as our lead magnet, and then we could invite people to watch it in person? But I could envision them pitching it like that. You know, it's if you already spend the majority of your budget on online advertising, then you're familiar with the whole concept of having to make very enticing lead magnets and having to really capture someone's attention so that you figure out who your watchers are, and you can track people more effectively, and it gives you a good increase, you know, into that information. So I can see it from that angle. I think it would be difficult for an attraction, maybe who does a lot of physical advertising, to push this kind of an asset creation. But basically, I like it because it's, you know, you're creating an asset of value, which is a live concert series and the videos. Then you can keep getting value out of those assets.
Oh, definitely. And speaking of content marketing, your next story here is another great example.
Yeah, so it goes into a great asset creation as well. So the title of the article is, and it's from the Derby Telegraph in the UK, is Secrets of the Wicker Man at Alton Towers Revealed. And I'm going to read a quote here from the article. Filmed over several months, the documentary follows the team as they complete construction of Wicker Man, a family thrill ride with a huge sculpture at its heart that appears to burst into flames as the ride rushes through it. As the resort was preparing to open the attraction to the public, senior members of the Alton Towers team revealed to the documentary how important the success of the 16 million ride is. There's a one-off Channel 4 show documentary that's being made for this new ride that they're doing. I don't think that the theme park commissioned it, but it's like they're working very closely with the directors of that. And this is to me, a two-part campaign. I mean, I think it's great content marketing because you're creating, you're working with a team to create this awesome asset, which is the video, this documentary style of this amazing thrill ride where part of it like bursts into flame. But it's also like an honest repositioning for the brand. Like they had a safety incident later where some people lost a leg. And so they're using this as a way to really peel back the curtain and reveal how much, you know, safety and engineering goes into this whole process, and put like a face on who does all these things to humanize it, to better position it. I like it for both those angles. I think I'm just kind of less interested in the positioning as more interested in the opportunity here for attractions to be creating content that then our assets, you know, this documentary will always be an asset that's out there in the world, that's living, that helps get people excited about what they're going to spend money to do. So I like that angle a lot for it. So I'm excited to see how this will turn out. But
yeah, and this is a perfect example of an idea that any attraction, no matter the size, could employ. And I found that behind the scenes content works so well. And before the show, we were talking about how we're surprised we don't see more behind the scenes content from attractions, especially larger attractions. And from my experience in the attractions industry, I think behind the scenes content is sometimes hard to produce, both to get the budget for something that is not necessarily ROI based, that's not going to show that direct return on ad spend. But also the other challenge is just trying to produce that content, you know, with, unless you're hiring a professional team and getting, you know, the operations and all the different departments aligned, can be a real challenge to produce high quality content like that. But when it is produced, it lives out there forever, as you mentioned. And even if it's not super high quality, I feel like guests and, you know, potential customers, potential guests, they love seeing that peek behind the curtain. You know, more and more, the whole idea of not showing how the magic happens is just not as compelling, you know, with the internet. Like people know that, the attractions are tricks of technology and ingenuity and art, and they just love, you know, making of videos. I wish I would see more of those from different attractions out there, and hopefully we will as video content becomes more and more important.
So the main topic, upcharging.
We're adding value.
That's right. We're adding value. That's what
a marketer would call it, right?
So adding value, I think that this is a good counterbalance to our last episode about essentially, you know, discounting and whether you should discount. And we talked briefly about my stance always of wanting to add value to situations rather than go in and negative value out. So we wanted to explore more in depth a little bit about how do you think about what you could do to add value and think about this in more dimensions. I guess it's always harder. You know, it's always harder for people to say, well, you know, the ticket is the ticket and this is the ticket price. And then going beyond that mentality to think, what are the other opportunities that you have to make the experience better for the people that would like a better experience, like for your super fans? You know, your super fans would want more of an experience, and how do you craft that for them? So Brad, why don't you start us off?
You've seen regional theme parks aggressively pursue charging more and being able to get more money out of every guest the last few years. And the reason that they've had to do that is that the US market is a very mature market for most of the regional parks. You're not seeing a significant number of new theme parks opening. I mean, I don't think there's been a successful new theme park that's opened in the US, you know, outside of a Disney or Universal park in what, probably a couple of decades. And so what you have is you have a, you know, certain number of guests. And of course, you always want to slowly increase that attendance every single year in an established market like the U.S. But, you know, in a good year, you're going up maybe 5 to 10%. Now, this is excluding Disney and Universal. And but for the most part, in the U.S. and really in North America overall, the most theme parks are really happy if they grow 1 to 5% in attendance, right? And of course, your operating costs are going to continue to grow as minimum wage gets higher, as, you know, cost of goods get more expensive. And so that's where this big shift's been happening. That's why you've seen, you know, upcharging like, you know, dining plans and from the line, you know, Max Pass, different, you know, hotels popping up that are adding value, but are also getting more money out of the guests instead of having them stay off site. So there's, you know, there's a variety of ways that upcharging, you know, happens in the industry. Premium parking, I mean, there's, you know, you go on and on and on. Photo passes, just anything that can get a few extra dollars out of a guest. But I think the key to being successful with this is when you are charging, you're getting more money out of a guest, but they're feeling like they're getting significantly more value. And bigger attractions look at this, actually even smaller attractions hopefully do this as well, of doing survey results and seeing if you can see trends between guests who are buying front of the line access or buying a dining plan. You know, is there a trend, are, you know, across the board, are they feeling like they're getting more value from your attraction? Because if you're doing upcharging and adding value correctly, upcharging can work really well for you and can be a huge value for your guest, perceived value. An example of this is, you know, dining plans. Six Flags in their recent email blast have been talking about how, you know what, we know food's really expensive here. They actually used that in, I believe it was an email blast last week. And if you get a dining plan, it's almost as affordable as eating at home. And if you eat, you know, at least three or four times in a year, you're going to make this worth it, right? And so for the guests that are buying that dining plan, they're feeling that value, even though statistically, obviously Six Flags is not having guests that are eating, you know, 5, 10, 15 times a year, because otherwise they wouldn't be able to make money off those dining plans. But the guest is seeing that perceived value. Either up front, they can easily imagine that they're going to eat, you know, 3 or 4 times, or, you know, the food costs are low enough that even if they eat 5 or 6 times, they feel like, wow, I'm saving a lot of money because I'm not paying $20 or something a meal. You know, same thing with front of the line. And I think front of the line is probably the first place that a smaller attraction would start. Unless you're doing, you know, food and beverage or have an opportunity to do premium parking or some of these other, you know, added value upcharge ideas. I think, I think front of the line is the place I see most attractions start at. Now with front of the line, you have to make sure that if they're paying $10, $20, $100 for this front of the line pass, that they're getting a significant more value than the guest who is not paying it. Because that's where an added value and upcharging, you know, goes wrong in a lot of ways, is when you have a guest that's spending significantly more than a normal ticket, and yet they're having either a worse experience or not a significantly better experience than, you know, guests with a normal ticket. So that's something you have to be really careful about. And you can do that by just designing your upcharges in a way that ensure that your guest is going to fill that extra value. And when you do that, then that's the magic, right? Where you're getting more money from a guest, they're happier. You know, a lot of times I know in my experience, I don't think I can share the exact details, but I'll just say that a lot of the front of the line guests, even though they're spending significantly more on a busy day, they are waiting less and they're getting their money's worth. And they are having, you know, the surveys will show that they are having a much, much better experience and are more likely to return than a normal guest. But on the flip side, you have to make sure that your normal guest doesn't feel slighted because they didn't pay that upcharge. So it becomes a real balancing act. And I've seen major attractions have a difficult time with this, right? Because obviously you need to make more money, but you can't have an impact that normal guest experience either. Because over time, what you're going to do is you're going to have short-term profits, but long-term, you're going to have less guest satisfaction and less returning guests. So that's sort of an overview of upcharging. Philip, I know you had a really, really great example from Airbnb and how they approach it. And I think the way they approach it, which you'll describe in a second, is how all attractions should be thinking about it. It's not so much a how do I get an extra dollar out of this, but how do I design a better experience for a select number of guests who want to spend more to get this better experience?
Yes. So I want to take just one step back. I think Brad did a great job of giving these concrete examples and understanding that the true value has to be there. I guess from an in the weeds situation where you're looking at it and you're like, you're trying to add on these little things, you know, like what about giving away water? Or what about doing front of the line? You know, you come at it from these small little iterations, right? You come at it like, well, you start at the base ticket and then you try and add little things up and you're not really sure whether or not those are things that people want or not. You're just kind of shooting that. That's, I've had dozens of these conversations. I see the person move from that angle. So I don't think that's the right way to approach the concept of what an upcharge or, you know, this added value experience could be. It's kind of a dual thing where you're in the wrong mindset because you're coming at it from trying to make tick marks going up. And you're also not coming at it from the idea of what kind of the perfect experience at your attraction looks like. And then realistically where the regular ticket is on that scale. And then figuring out what does it look like and what are the actual elements in here that make it a perfect night. There is a story that I heard on a podcast recently that absolutely blew my mind when it came to explaining this concept and actually giving a great exercise for it. The podcast is Masters of Scale, which is a incredible podcast. And it's with Brian Chesky, which is the co-founder and CEO of Airbnb. And I'm going to link to the specific episode and the transcript in the show notes, but it's an episode, it's called Handcrafted is the episode. And I'll give you a very brief run through, but the basic premise that Brian was saying is that you have to handcraft the experience until it hurts. And that's the process of scaling. So what he means is, you know, they were manually doing all of the paperwork for Airbnb sales when it first started until it was like painful, like until they were up all night doing that. And then they hired somebody. Like they were still physically mailing checks to Airbnb hosts until they couldn't keep up with all the checks they had to mail, which is when they went and got software. And the same thing, like they were handcrafting experiences until it hurt. That's how they knew where to scale. But what that allowed him to do was actually handcraft the perfect guest experience. So, you know, he contacted a traveler and watched a traveler come to San Francisco from overseas and like had him do the San Francisco vacation the way that the guests would have planned it, and watched him do all the touristy stuff and all that. And he like photo journaled everything and they followed him around and they invited him back, except when they invited him back, they planned the perfect experience for him in San Francisco and they plan the perfect, like everything perfect. Like, you know, we arranged car service for you and we got you the best restaurants for that the locals go to that are impossible because all the locals love it. And we planned all these activities for you and we planned opportunities for you to meet people and all this stuff and made this perfect experience. And you know, the guy was just like in tears at the end. It was like the best trip he'd ever had in his life. And they're like, okay. So then they sat down, they're like, what does a 10-star experience look like? So like, what is a 3-star? You know, what is a one star? One star is, you know, it's terrible. A three star is like, okay, but an okay experience is actually much, much closer to what we think of. So if you think about it in a theme park, like what is a three star experience? Like a three star is like, you still expect it to operate, you know, like it's like you go in and you go in, you wait in line for a ticket and then you go in and you have, I guess, like an average day, is a three, but the average day is still everything operating. Like it's still the majority of the park services. You know, it's probably just not being able to get a fast pass for one of your rides if you're at Disney. And so you miss going on one of the, like one of the Three Mountains or something, or, you know, you're going to Disney World for the first time and you don't realize that the fast passes can be booked 30 to 60 days in advance. And so you don't get to, your daughter doesn't get to go on the Frozen ride because it's all booked up. And then the wait time is like 3 hours. So, you know, maybe that's a three star because you kind of sit in this middle road where you still get to do stuff, but it's the middle. So, you know, what does a five star look like? Is a five star where you do all of your, you get, if you're at Disneyland, you know, you get to do the Three Mountains and you have a character greeting and you never wait more than 30 minutes for a ride and you, you get a good, you know, a meal you think was actually worth it and whatnot. You know, is that a five star? But then jump and be like, what is a 10 star or an 11 star? You know, what do you need to do? Like kind of free your mind from the constraints of what it would look like. So in this scenario, he was like, you know, if a five star is they give you recommendations and all this stuff, you know, and then if we planned everything, like the one that we planned with this guy is that a seven star where, you know, there's a car service and all this stuff is done for you. But like, what is a 10 star? Is a 10 star, you know, or 11 star? Is that where you get off the plane and there's people waiting for you and they cheer for you? You know, like some of these things are unrealistic, obviously, but somewhere in there, you're going to come across the perfect guest experience. And what I really liked about his example was actually handcrafting it for one person and doing that a few times so they understand what it looked like to that person. Like they got their mind into thinking about what stars need to align to make this a perfect trip. My point is, you know, decoupling your brain from what you think an added value experience is for the guest and think of it more in terms of what is an average experience for a guest, and then like what would a five star be, but then what would a 10 star be for our park? And what would a perfect day look like to them? You know, what would it be like for them? What are all the factors that have to align to make this happen? I think that'll get you thinking about what then, you know, there's a lot of things that are just not at all possible. Obviously, the majority of stuff is impossible when you know, five star, but then you're doubling it to 10 star. And to be clear, you know, this is a five star and a 1 to 5 star rating. And then you have to double that to 10 stars. So it's kind of like blowing your guest's mind completely out of the water. It's like, okay, well, this isn't even things that we thought were possible, which I think is the real value in added value is going to a place that the guest doesn't even know that they need. But once you give them the option, it like blows their mind when they do the experience, right? You know, would it be possible to figure out where your guest was staying and to have like a limo come pick them up and, you know, bypass the line where they go right into the park and they do not just a guided tour, but maybe they get to be a scare actor in an area, you know, and kind of everything is taken care of seamlessly. You know, like what level star would that, and would that be possible? And is that value that they would enjoy, you know? So I think that's the background is, I guess, to summarize all of that, when you're looking at added value opportunities, don't come at it from starting with this is what we currently offer and what thing could we add on to this, you know, that's a few dollars that would maybe make a better value. You know, like we could give them lunch. Well, you know, lunch really costs us this, but if they paid for it in the park, it would be this. And so if we wrap that into the ticket, we give them a little bit of a discount for this added value thing. So basically we split the cost with them. So we make a little bit less margin, but they feel like they've gotten value. That's not a good way to do added value. Because in summer, you know, you don't know that's what they actually want. You don't know if that makes their experience better. You don't know all these things. You're just kind of sitting guessing from your perspective. The two things I would suggest is see if you can craft the ultimate guest experience, handcraft it like they did with Airbnb. And then also do this thought exercise of imagining, so these are our 5-star reviews, and this is what a guest says made them a 5-star day. You know, all these things happen. Okay. So if we were to make a 10-star, like if this is 5-star and we just like, in, you know, got it to 10 stars, what would that even conceivably look like? You know, and it gets your brain out of the construct of this is what a regular experience at, you know, at a theme park is. And it gets you thinking about what kind of what could be. So anyway, that's my summary. Anyway.
Yeah. No, that's a great summary. And I think, you know, obviously add value is going to be very specific to every single attraction, but hopefully, you know, our conversation gives you, gives our audience an idea of some of the possibilities. And the biggest takeaway, as you mentioned, is just how, you know, the approach to the take when you're considering this, and definitely look in the show notes, listen to the Masters of Scale Airbnb podcast, because that was a really eye-opening for me. And I just love the approach that they took that you described. Well, that wraps up episode 26. Before we go, I want to remind you, make sure you visit marketingyourattraction.com to read blog posts of past episodes, and also to download our whole archive of past episodes. Obviously, this is episode 26. So if you're just joining us now, we have, you know, a number of great episodes that we've recorded over the past year or so. And make sure you subscribe to the podcast and leave a review on iTunes or your favorite podcast player. Let us know what you like, what you don't like, what topics you want us to cover. You can also contact us by going to marketingyourattraction.com. And Philip, before we wrap up, we got to tell them about Seasonal Entertainment Source, the magazine that you're working on.
Yes. So to get a free physical subscription to Seasonal Entertainment Source, just go to seasonalentertainmentsource.com. As one word, seasonalentertainmentsource.com. We mail out every quarter. And so if you get on the list now, the next one you'll get is the December issue, because we just mailed out September this week. But yeah, it's every issue is an improvement on the previous one. And it's pretty exciting to see it evolve.
Awesome. Well, thanks again for joining us. We'll talk to you next episode.